It's Illum Group's Andrea Lay, PacView's Melissa Burdick, the Wizard of Woodland Hills, Sri, and I'm PVSB from Flywheel, a division of Omnicom, and I'm coming to you today from the Catskills. I'll be playing Heckingers Tuesdays and Thursdays. Before we get to the CBG Guys episode you've downloaded, it's the week of May 6th, and it's time for the Fresh Four. Four curated news stories from the past week. We find them dependably intriguing. We hope you do too. We're brought to you through our partnership with RetailWit, your one-stop shop for retail industry intelligence news. RetailWit.com. It's retail right now. Over to you, Sri.
In case you're wondering what this background is, I'm at my father-in-law's house all the way in Chennai, India for the next couple of weeks. So what's the message of the week? Kroger Precision Marketing strikes a partnership with none other than Yahoo DSP. So Yahoo DSP advertisers now have access to KPM's audiences for both reach and measurement. Partnership marks KPM's second DSP partnership since last fall and ushers in a new focus on commerce media for Yahoo advertising in particular. Collaborations like this one will define the next phase of growth in retail media as retailers recognize the limitations of monetization on their own digital properties and seek incremental growth by expanding offsite. This is said by Sara Marzano, principal analyst at eMarketer. For advertisers, the delayed but still impending deprecation of third-party cookies, which is now on its way, continues to underpin every decision regarding digital advertising dollars. So solutions that safeguard their investments against that will hold increasing appeal. Over to you, Andrea.
Hello, Fresh Four listeners. Walmart adds a new grocery line to its private brands portfolio. Walmart has announced a new private label grocery brand called Better Goods. The line includes 300 items spanning categories such as frozen, dairy, snacks, beverages, pasta, soups, coffee, and chocolate. With most items priced under $5, Better Goods focuses on three key components: culinary experiences, plant-based, and made without. The retailer said Better Goods marks not only its largest private food brand launch in two decades, but also its fastest grocery brand brought to market. Over to you, Melissa.
Thanks, Andrea. So Save Mart companies roll out in-store retail media networks. It's not enough that we have online. Now we're moving to in-store retail media networks. The Save Mart companies plans to roll out In-Store Connect, an in-store retail media network powered by Quad Graphics Inc. To start, 16 of the grocery company stores will have digital screens, kiosks, end caps, shelf screens, and vertical banners throughout, allowing CPG partners to showcase promotions, product information, and recommendations to shoppers. The program will eventually roll out to all of the Save Mart companies, approximately 200 stores. This is Save Mart's latest retail media effort, coming almost a year after a launch of its own retail media network. Over to you, Peter.
Thanks, Melissa. Rite Aid expands Uber Eats partnership for alcohol delivery in 8 states. Nearly 1,000 Rite Aid stores will now offer alcohol delivery via retailers' expanded partnership with Uber Eats. Customers of legal drinking age can get delivery from select stores in California, Idaho, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Virginia, and Washington. Quote, our collaboration and trusted partnership with Uber Eats underscores our commitment to meet the evolving needs of our customers and providing a seamless digital shopping experience that complements their busy lives, unquote, said Jeannie Walden, Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer at Rite Aid, the U.S.'s third largest pharmacy retailer. That's it for the Fresh Four. Now on to the CPG Guys episode that you've downloaded. Welcome to another episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Our co-hosts, Sri Rajagopalan and Peter V.S. Bond, explore how brands and retailers engage with consumers online, in-store, and everywhere in between. And now, here are Sri and Peter.
Hey everyone, it's PVSB. I'm one of the CPG Guys. I'm pleased to be joined by the other CPG Guy. He's my West Coast counterpart, live from LA, it's Sri, and we want to welcome you to In the Know, our LinkedIn Live series. And I know it's been a while since we engaged in what we call gratuitous rank punditry about the industry, so we thought we'd host a live chat on a Saturday afternoon with some of our best friends, our closest followers. So thank you for joining us on the long weekend. And of course, if you're not already doing so, please follow us on LinkedIn. Sri, hey, how you doing today? What's going on, man?
Mr. Bond, happy birthday, America.
And of course,
for those of you listening in from Canada, happy Canada Day, which just passed by. weekend filled with sunshine, barbecues, picnics, hopefully beaches. I'm trying to convince the fam we need to go to Santa Barbara Beach. Haven't had success so far, but still working on it, Peter. What about you?
Well, we celebrated Canada Day on Friday. My mom's down visiting from Halifax, so that was great. And Monday, we're going over to Zara's dad's house, a couple towns over, and we're going to celebrate Independence Day here in America. So a truly North American little get-together, shall we say.
How about that, Peter? It sounds like barbecues on the cards.
I know. So love seeing everybody here today. What I'd say is we've got a lot of topics. We haven't done this in a while, Sri. It's just you and me. We don't have a guest. We figured there are a bunch of things we'd like to – people have asked us, what's your point of view? And we figured, well, we'll just host another event where we kind of give our impressions on some of the hot topics of the day. So if you have any topics, please just add them into the comment section. We'll try and address them as we're going along. But should be a good one. Sound good, Sri?
And Peter, for the record, this was never about how many. Actually, it's the long weekend. It's July 4th. Yeah. You know, we felt it's been, we should do a half-year perspective on 2022 and how the industry, what the state of the industry is and what things are evolving, et cetera. And that's what today's about. And
yeah, it should be fun. Should be fun, right? Yeah, it'll be good. And I think we talked about this after we're done with the recording. We'll probably post this up on the podcast so that people who weren't live with us can listen in, but it should be fun. Exactly. So why don't we get to it, Sri? I'll throw the first one to you. Let's talk about halfway through 2022. Kind of what's the state of omnichannel, e-commerce versus in-store, and kind of everywhere in between. You know, what's winning, if there is such a word in winning right now.
So if you actually analyze the data and you look at footfall, trips, things of that nature, I think it's no secret, no magic here on the CPG guys, that in 2020, e-commerce really inflects big time due to hygienity, convenience, whatever the case might have been, based on an individual family. The mistake people made was to assume stores were shutting down, the word retail apocalypse. Have you noticed how that's vanished from the vocabulary? And the store apocalypse especially has vanished from the vocabulary, but there was a certain period, I would say, for a year, given March 2020 through about summer 2021, where the emphasis was definitely e-commerce. I don't even want to say omnichannel. E-commerce, e-commerce, e-commerce. And then some portion of that e-commerce was omnichannel because it was less home delivery. There was more home delivery. There was some click and collect. And the last couple of years was the e-commerce moment. So if you are in the business of brands or retail and you missed the bus on really muscling up on e-commerce, which is home delivery, pickup, whatever, using third-party intermediaries, whatever the mechanism might be, that window is actually now past. So I hope you had a chance to get into that window, that door, that open. While it's never too late and you can always beef up and muscle up, that large growth window is definitely past. Traffic's coming back in store, and I'll tell you, for the most part, most decisions in the United States are still made based on a planogram, which is really in store. And that's what scale has always been about. Scale is about, and 20 years from now, scale will be about how much distribution points you can get in the United States. So if you ask me who's winning, e-commerce did for a couple of years. It established its purpose. The action is back to what it should be, which is omnichannel, e-commerce being a piece of it. But traffic is definitely coming back in store. Brace up for back to school. Brace up for the holiday season, which results, Peter and me, going to a different topic, but kind of an offshoot. Many, especially the ones in New York and big cities, really beefed up for 10-minute delivery, 15-minute delivery, 30-minute delivery. And we had this race for who can deliver the fastest and maximum assortment. Over the course of the last 8-odd weeks, many have collapsed, Peter. What's going on?
I'll tell you, Sri, the question that always hit me as these services started to appear is, who's asking for it? Like, who's actually asking to have that 10-minute or 20-minute delivery window? Like, I understand when I look at what GoPuff did, right? It's not so much they offer an immediate needs delivery. It's the fact that over half of their volume is occurring during hours that most of the rest of the industry is abandoned, which is 9:30 p.m. to 4 a.m. So I'm more impressed with that aspect of their business, but I'm not surprised about the fact that you're seeing Joker drawing out and Gorilla unable to get funding, and even, frankly, GoPuff having to make some headcount reductions, because the research, what we saw some research a couple months ago that argued that every single immediate delivery transaction loses $20. I mean, at some point that's going to come back. And when the capital markets and venture capital start to dry up as they have over the last couple of months, you have these big banks that aren't going to fund the growth of these companies anymore. And all of a sudden now is the profitability model working. So I'm not surprised by that. I listened back to the episode we had at the end of last year, our final episode with Gildenberg. And Brian was talking about there's got to be a lot of consolidation that's going to happen. And whether that consolidation is going to occur with any of the ones I mentioned, or it's going to be one of the big players. Maybe it's Uber Eats. Maybe Amazon takes that on and becomes that capability. But I think the point of having 7 or 8 different delivery systems all blanketing the same geographic area, trying to deliver products and then trying to do so in an immediate need basis, it's just the mechanics for scale, as you like to say, just aren't there. So I'm not surprised by this. I don't know where it's going to end up. I've always felt that immediate needs were much more of a heavy, densely populated urban area where they've always worked, honestly, from pizza delivery to you name it. But I'm really not convinced that this is going to be a viable long-term delivery mechanism for last mile in consumer packaged goods. That would be my thought. So Sri, let's move over to kind of the new cool stuff that's going on from the customer experience perspective. We've had a couple of guests on. We've talked about this. There is substantial growth in live streaming. It started with TikTok. It's carried over to Instagram. And now retailers are doing it on their site. Brands are doing it on their site. And they're also using video in short form, in searchable video. And there's just a lot of transformation going on. What are your thoughts of where we are? Are we at the apex? Or are we just at the beginning of the race? What's going on here?
So video streaming and live streaming, you know, why did it take this long, right? It's important to acknowledge that availability of bandwidth, availability of Wi-Fi needed to, and the availability of the actual device, which I think it's safe to say is a smartphone versus a tablet or any other mechanism such as a Mac or a laptop. They all needed to have fast enough processors to manage live streaming, live video, and the bandwidth needed to be good enough. But guess what, Peter? Over COVID, that's exactly what's happened. The bandwidths are good enough. Video streaming has enough computer horsepower, the chip. And when you take those two, it's actually a pretty potent combination that what's the best way to show emotions for any product, for any retailer, when a product is actually fulfilled or a consumer can find a product or consumes a product or unboxes a product. It's the physical emotion of happiness, the physical emotions of disappointment, and it's best captured on video live when it's actually taking place. And then communications, no different. If you want to get a message through, such as, Peter, why are we doing a LinkedIn live today? We're a podcast. The best mechanism is real time. Get your message through as fast as you can. So to me, I can no longer say video and live streaming are the tip of the iceberg. They're certainly well on their way. If the index were 100, they've crossed at 25, they're building. Go forward to something bigger and better. Every brand and retailer should really be thinking about how they can leverage the role of, while we aren't planning to really get deep into influencers today, they should be thinking about influencers who show that human emotion and the connection to usability, the sensibility, touch, feel, smell of a product live online. And video streaming and live streaming is here to stay, but more importantly, it's here to grow leaps and bounds exponentially brands, it needs to be part of your marketing mix, not negotiable. I've said that about D2C in the past 3 years ago, but I've changed my tone on D2C because it's come across a whole maturity. At some point it was. Now I'm telling you that maturity, but in the immature phase of live streaming and video, folks, take it seriously. It needs to be part of your marketing mix.
Are you telling me that you're going to put money down on the fact that Smell-O-Vision is coming to a computer near you?
Peter, none of us would have thought, you know, the Wall Street Journal article today on the iPhone evolution.
Right, I saw that.
I believe it was 3 inches, and that's what we were using in the BlackBerry. And I can't get my spelling right today on a very large iPhone 13 Pro XS, the largest size they make. How did I do it on the BlackBerry? It's like human evolution. And I won't be in shock if down the line there's something to that nature. And why not? You know, why not? We never thought we'd have electric cars. I have two. They're kind of crazy, right? But back to live streaming and video, right?
Yeah.
Those are all, at the end of the day, pieces of content for communication, efficacy, value, quality, things of that nature for a retailer or a brand, Peter. So that content is going more and more digital. Does it impact her when she's standing in front of the shelf? Like, does she really look at content? Does she care?
Yeah, actually she does. And you know how we know that? Our friends at Walmart Connect released some really interesting information just a couple of weeks ago that said that 82% of Walmart in-store shoppers use the Walmart app or use the Walmart website on mobile devices while they're walking through stores. And when they do that, it's not just a quick little something. It's between 2 and 4 searches. So they're searching out content. They're searching out prices. They're searching out information. They're searching out ratings and reviews to help make an informed purchase decision. So, you know, I guess the question becomes, does digital content influence in-store purchases beyond driving the trip? Does it actually alter the trip while they're in the store? And I think what Walmart told us is undeniably yes. We also know that the other proof point we have is what our friend Barbara Connors from 8451 shared with us in the hybrid shopper, how people are using content and how they're shopping online and in-store. And it really is true, Sri. We're seeing an enormous amount of digital content that is designed to attract the attention and satisfy the information needs of shoppers while they're walking through physical stores.
That, Peter, obviously leads to, I want to come back to D2C, right? It was hot during COVID because home delivery was a piece of it. And is probably still the best mechanism to collect 1P data, right? And if I've said that, and does it make you feel that's still the case? Like, is D2C equally relevant today? And are there other mechanisms for 1P data? Do brands rely on creating this whole machine called D2C?
I guess the question is, what's the outcome you're looking for? Like, if you say you want to create a D2C for the outcome of getting 1P data, I don't know that that's necessarily what you should be doing, because it's a lot of work to get something that you can get elsewhere. You know, the outcome you should be looking for is, well, I want to build a D2C site because it's going to create a great customer experience and I'm going to get to know them a little better. But I mean, yeah, there's lots of places you can go get more meaningful 1P data. You've got great data interchanges like what Snowflake has enabled, right? To go out and get all this data set. Certainly, you made reference to what's going on at Fetch Rewards. We're tracking almost 15 million monthly active users at an item level. That's over $110 billion in annual gross merchandise value. So you want 1P customer data, you can go out and find it in spades. So I think that where D2C is shifting, Sri, honestly, is away from this concept of I have to have a D2C site, and more, I need content that can enable commerce, right? So let's talk a little bit about, you know, shoppable media, right? That's where I think brands should be focusing their attention. Helping people.
Yeah, I'm going to get to shoppable media in a bit, Peter. But when you talk about shoppable media, the first thing, you know, first thing I want you to do, Peter, is you work for Fetch Rewards. You just referred to it. Give us the one-on-one. Why should anybody bet on Fetch Rewards?
Well, Fetch Rewards is interesting because it puts the consumer at the center of the value proposition. Instead of having to go out and jump through hoops and prove your loyalty as a consumer to a retailer or to a brand, what Fetch is saying to you is go buy any product you want anywhere you want and just share your transaction with us. Snap a picture of your physical receipt or let us read your, you know, your email e-com transactions, and we'll reward you for that. We'll give you points, points that you can use for gift cards from your favorite retailer, Walmart, Target, Amazon, Nordstrom's, Macy's, merchandise, get a nice Fetch t-shirt, experiences, give it to charity, whatever it is. But we're not going to make you jump through hoops and we're not going to tell you. Now, there may be some offers that say buy it at this retailer and you'll get a little bit extra. But at the end of the day, it's rewarding you for products you like to buy. And that's the value proposition. What brands get for it is brands that are in our closed loop ecosystem see dramatically higher shares than they do in the real world, like to the tune of 2x. So you think of any brand that's out there. If you have a 30 market share and you come into a closed loop environment like Fetch with 15 million shoppers, and now I'm giving you a 60 share, that's kind of worth it, isn't it? And you're not facing, you know, you're owning those categories. So it's not like you're on 1 week and then your competitor's on the next week. And that just causes this, you know, tit for tat shifting around of volume. It builds long-term loyalty. And with that comes an enormous amount of insight and engagement that really allows you to build long-lasting relationships with those users. So from, you know, from Fetch's perspective, is it growing? Yeah, we're growing like crazy. We'll be 20 million by the end of the year. And we're big enough now, Sri, that, you know, when I was at NACDS earlier this year, retailers that met with us, they came ready. They knew who we were. They were well aware of it. And they were ready to talk about what we could do to help them, just like we're helping brands grow their business. Retailers see us as a source of omni-channel purchasing behavior. You know that even among some a grocery retailers, say top 5% most loyal shoppers, trips and spend 40 cents or more of every dollar those shoppers, their most loyal shoppers, 40 cents or more of every dollar they spend on CPG products are bought outside of that retailer. So there's an enormous amount of opportunity for retailers to capture bigger share of wallet, right? So everyone's interested in this data set, and no one else is doing that. And that's why I think it's sustainable.
Well said, Peter, at the end of the day. So you referred to shoppable media.
Yeah.
Let's cut to the chase, Peter. You and I have experienced many. We talk to so many in the industry here on the CPG guys. Who's your pick for shoppable media? I know mine. Let's hear yours.
Yeah. I'll tell you this, and they were on our show earlier this year in January, but there's one player out of Minneapolis called Pair Commerce, and I think they've built a better mousetrap in two respects. The first one is they really are full funnel, and I think full funnel is important. Full funnel isn't just add to basket and walk away. Full funnel is I need to understand, is there conversion going on? Because if not, I want to be able to do what I would be able to do if I were a digitally native brand and I was direct to consumer, which is retarget for abandoned baskets and other things like that. And I also want to understand how much volume my transaction that my product delivered to the retailer is bringing to that retailer. So I want to understand that whole basket. So being able to get that conversion metric and how much that basket was worth is a really powerful way for a brand to say to a retailer, I'm investing in driving volume to you and to this tone. So that's really powerful. The thing that really blew me away about Pair Commerce, Sri, is they're not like the other guys where they have the top 20 retailers. I mean, they have the top 20 retailers, right? But they spent years building out, painstakingly building out relationships with 2,000 small and medium-sized retailers in the market. And you may sit there and say, well, what's the value prop in that, right, Sri? The value prop is what they tell us is that roughly 40% of all the ad baskets are going to that tail of 2,000. If you don't, if you're missing that opportunity, you're not giving your shopper the retail options that they really want to make that purchase. Yeah, and because what happens if they really only use that big national retailer on a very rare basis to go make a single transaction? They do all their stock up and their fill-ins at their local regional grocery retailer. If that's not an option, then you know what? That probably is going to be an abandoned basket. Of course, you'll never know that with the other guys because they're not giving you those conversion metrics. So I think they've built a better mousetrap. I'd love to know your thoughts on this.
Yeah, no debate in my head. To me, the full funnel is a big game changer. The fact that they're focused, you've already explained that, but you also explained, you know, having the tail. So if you thought about how shopping takes place in America for groceries, basket-wise, it's taking place locally in and around the store and environments people live in. And majority of stores are local and they're super regional. And when you have the capability to be able to reach those super regional stores in the local areas where people shop, which is the, I would call the, from a scale perspective, tier two and tier three grocers who've got 100 stores, 200 stores, you know, less than 500 stores, 70 stores. That's like, as you said, 40% of all add to baskets and probably 60, 70% of all shopping in the United States today. So I'm going to clearly say, hey, when you have that capability, you're going to be a total standout in terms of shoppable media. So good luck to Pair Commerce. Congratulations on all the growth you guys have demonstrated. And hopefully y'all keep hitting it out of the park. And just a fun statistic, Peter, I looked up our top downloaded episode and Pair Commerce has clawed its way all the way up to number 12.
That is pretty huge.
Challenge for them. You need to be in the top 10 so you can feature on our page. So they can have to figure out how to claw two spots.
There you go. Hey, so Sri, I want to go back to a topic that we just touched about because it does relate to Fetch, but it's this concept of retail 1P data. So, you know, who owns it? There are a lot of retailers out there that think that they own it, but do they own it? Who really owns the consumer's purchase data?
This answer is actually a very easy one, but just for fun and to tease it out, I'm going to answer it first by setting the stage with a long-winded answer. Okay. So if you think about data and how we've been using it traditionally in the CPG industry, is we've looked at data aggregators primarily to bring us as much data as they can because we wanted coverage and to know exactly the products that are being consumed and where they're being consumed, which parts of the country. We wanted to understand merchandising, its impact, et cetera, and data aggregators are best qualified to do that because they bring you the full picture. Over the course of the last 20-odd years, as channels started to proliferate, formats started to proliferate, it was hard for data aggregators to be able to collect all that data, and their coverage started dropping. 100, 70, 60, 50, and then digital came by and made it a whole lot more difficult. And a lot of retailers now said, why do we need to participate with data aggregation? We're pretty comfortable on our own managing the data and working with brand manufacturers directly. And now we've gone to the next evolution where brands have said, wait, if I have coverage for 60% and I simply have nothing for the balance 40 and it's selective based on if I am I a category captain, yes, no. How do I run a business model in an ecosystem where I've got 60% coverage and I'm making decisions on the basis of 60. All that was fine, Peter, 2 years ago. But all of a sudden, what happened in the last 20 months, 24 months is the availability of product on the shelf or on-shelf availability has taken a wild swing. No one's fault. That's the way the labor market is. That's the way commodities and ingredient availability is. Transportation and shipping have become harder due to labor challenges. What happens in that sort of environment? The retailer that wins is the one that can get product on its shelf. What's the best way you can get product on your shelf? Being communicative and informative to your brand partners. Hey, this is what's going on the shelf. This is where I am out of stock. Here's why I need more product. Can you help me out? Can we work on this together? Who else is getting stock? Things of that nature. And those have been some of the questions in the industry, no matter what category you are in a grocery store these days. And so a year, 2 years ago, retailers have said, look, I need to start sharing it. And now if you ask brands across the spectrum of categories, brands are going to tell you, yeah, I'm being approached by this retailer, retailer A, B, C, D, E, multi-channel, multi-format, super regional, as the case may be, with the availability of data. So that's what I told you, Peter, I'm teasing and setting the stage. Now I'll answer the question, your exact question, who owns the data? That answer is actually very simple. The one who generates the data owns the data, very similar to the one who generates the IP owns the IP. And so if we were strictly to talk ownership and nothing else, if in this case, 1P data coming from a retailer is owned by the retailer because they're the ones generating it with the transaction. But way above and beyond all of that, Peter, the thing that matters the most is who creates that data in the first place, the shopper, the consumer. They own the data. They're the ones that are generating it.
That's absolutely the answer, Peter.
They own the data. They created. Without them, there's nobody. So it's the consumer, the shopper. It's not even the consumer, the shopper that creates the transaction that owns the data.
I think too many retailers think that it's their data. And sometimes they don't like when other people are doing things with data that came through their stores. But it's the shopper who decides to, if they're not deciding themselves through partnerships, and a shopper decides, I'm going to share the data with someone else in exchange for some value, that's entirely up to the shopper.
Absolutely. And that's why there's always a privacy check, right? They can say, no, I opt out. I don't want to share my data.
Yeah. But so but why do they opt out? Because they own it. Because they absolutely own it. And the laws recognize that. I think that's spot on.
Yeah, I don't think we can debate that the consumers at the end of the day create the data. They're the ones who originated. They have some strong sense of ownership in it. But I don't want to undermine the retailer's role in processing all these large quantities, transactions at the end of the day. So it's a good mixed ownership here, but I'm going to lean on the shopper, Peter, which results in my next question, which is shopper-oriented. And that has to do, you referred to them coming in store 82% of the time. They whip out a device or some sort of smartphone. They're looking at content, things of that nature. So obviously, the brands that are going to lead, retailers that are going to lead, are going to have a very digital mindset, and they're going to focus on advertising and search online. So that has resulted in retail media really going fast. You know, some days I think of it as one of the fastest growing line items for both brands and retailers. So can you tell us a little bit about what's next there and clearly explain to us the difference between first and second, like what's going on in that second price auction world?
Yeah. Before I do that, Sri, a quick shout out to our dear friend, Sean Riley from Dude Wipes and Dude Products. He commented in the chat channel that data is king. We could not agree more, Sean. Absolutely. So thank you for that.
I'm going to make a slight disagreement, Peter. I'm going to say data is queen.
Okay. Well, yes. Well, it's her, right? The shopper
it's
is
the empress,
her.
So. Because it's her.
Yeah, it is. You're right. You're absolutely right there.
I'm going to tell the king of Dude Wipes, dude, it's the empress. It's her.
It's the empress. The okay. There we go. Happiness is. So let's talk about retail media and what's next. I think there are a couple things that are top of mind to me, Sri. First is we're seeing optimization taking place very quickly. You may have noticed that a couple weeks ago, Walmart Connect announced they'd move to a second price auction. What does a second price auction mean? So for our audience, what it means is you're bidding against space for search at the top of the search results. Why is it important? It's important because eFundamentals tells us 60% of all add to baskets coming from search come from the first four spots on the page. That's all retail media. So that's why it's important. But the price that you pay is not the price that the highest bidder is bid. It's a penny more than the price that the second highest bidder has bid. That keeps it from getting crazy whack out of control. And so what happened as a result of that? I believe Walmart said that they saw an average decrease in the price that people were paying for retail media by something like 20%. It was like 19%, something like that, Sheree. So it's you know, that's what the market is demanding. Their competitors were doing it. Walmart Connect saw that. They added that capability, and what it means is it means that the budgets can go further. And that's very, very meaningful. I think the other thing that's really interesting is true omni-channel retail media solutions. So it's not just on-site. It's on-site. It's off-site. It's being able to use longitudinal purchasing behavior of a retailer to build audiences and target digital advertising off-site. And it's also in-store. And Walmart Connect is a great example where they you can one-stop shopping, you can go and do your on-site, your off-site, and your in-store all in one place. And I think we're seeing that. We've got someone coming up next week, Sheree. You and I are our dear friend Melissa Burdick is going to be from PacView is going to join us. She's going to bring along with her someone from Albertsons Media Collective. That's a an Easter egg we're sharing with people here. And that'll be our first talk with Albertsons Media Collective. But, you know, they're a true omni solution as well. And so I think increasingly, if you don't have all of those components off-site, on-site, and in-store, and you're an omni-channel retailer, you're probably kind of missing the boat because there's so much to be done there. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Sheree?
I can't wait to actually get to the Albertsons Media Collective conversation with Melissa Burdick. Yeah. And let's not name the guest. Let's keep it a surprise, but it'll be
keep
here
it
soon.
Super secret. I know.
On the link on CPG Guys here, will announce soon who it is. So watch out for our post on who it is. And it's the first time we're chatting with Albertsons. As y'all know, we've already talked to Walmart. We've talked to GoPuff. We've talked to Instacart. We've talked to Kroger, 8451.
HEB,
we got a lot going on. So,
hey, if you're a big retailer and you have retail media and you haven't come on the CPG Guys yet, come on and talk to us. We're the place where people go to talk retail media. I mean, increasingly, we are a great source of education.
That's the legends in our own mind's part, correct, Peter?
Well, you know what? We're the place people go to want to learn about retail media platforms and what they can do. So, if that's what we do,
Peter, you're saying we actually add value?
Well, we're the hacks. Our guests are the ones that add value, Sheree. We just
there we go. Now we said that straight, Peter. I'm going to since we've gone to the topic of retail media, I want to address another space which is hot, and that space is ROAS and ROI.
This is a debate, Sheree. Heavy debate. I know you have an opinion on there. Let me ask it of you: is ROAS really ROI? Because this is the question I think we need to address straight on. Because everybody since the beginning of Amazon advertising has been using the term ROAS, and I think you need to address this head on. Is that really ROI?
The answer is absolutely vehemently no. But I want to explain why by going to the definitions first. And by the way, the use of the ROAS predates Amazon, Facebook, Google, digital advertising. Sure. That's the way it's run. So what is ROAS? ROAS is return on ad spend. Every dollar you invest, so if I put a dollar based on the CPM, the cost per mile, the cost per click that I choose to invest in, how many dollars did I get back? So if I, let's keep this simple. I invested $10 in my cost per click and I made $28 in sales. My ROAS is 2.8. Clear, Peter, or make it even more simpler. I put $10, I sold $30 a product, my ROAS is 3. That was the metric forever. My question, Peter, is that could have been $3 a product with the lowest profitability possible. And so is that really a return on your investment? No, it's just return on the ad spend. And even better, Peter, what if the money was invested in search terms that are branded keywords? She's already searching for a brand. So she's well on the funnel, towards the lower side of the funnel. And yay, you won her transaction because she was already in the lower funnel. And that's what you bet on, branded keywords. And she found you faster than she did other brands because you were investing in search, which I'm not advocating don't do because you got to hold off conquesting, which we'll address on another episode of the CPG Guys. But ROAS is the simplest, unevolved form, 20 years old, of measuring how did my advertising do. I always ask anybody I meet in this space, if they come to me with ROAS, what's your ROI? And here are the return on investment, which is so much more than the ROAS. I'll start with the ROAS, how much should we sell? But I'll dig into a very important word. If I did not invest that dollar, would I have gotten fewer transactions? And to me, what was the incrementality by investing the dollar? Hey, had I gotten $18 in sales anyway, and I got 12 extra dollars from that $10 investment, which I otherwise wouldn't have gotten, that triumphs ROAS for me. And when someone walks in and shows me a 7 ROAS by investing in branded ketones, I'm like, come on, really? But Peter, I'm deeply, deeply trained in, you know, because I left corporate America for a year, launched and ran my own brand. I was logging into Facebook, logging into Google, Amazon ads, running my own campaigns. So I'm deeply trained in CPC, probably more than most of this industry, wearing the hat that I do for my day job and just being in and around the industry, looking at a shelf every single day. But I'll tell you, there's a big difference between ROAS and ROI. You got to ask the question, what's my ROAS? But you got to bet on the strength of your ROI. And if it's not delivering incrementality, that campaign in my eyes is flawed. I am that strong with my convictions on that. So people listening here, if you were to bring me ROAS, I will challenge you and ask you, what is your ROI on the campaign? It's not fair to measure. You are not using your dollars well, whether you're a publisher selling media or whether you're a investor buying media. If you're just measuring and celebrating ROAS, you're not doing right by the dollars. You need to get into the world of incrementality of ROI. Can I be more clear, Peter?
Sri, a couple things. First of all, I want to welcome the Baroness of Bentonville. She's made her appearance here. Hey, Whitney.
Hey.
You're with us. Whitney and Dehizzy.
You know, she doesn't like me saying that. She knew I would do that.
Okay, that's all right. But here's what I want us to add to what you said, Sri, which is for any media platform, ROAS is table stakes. If you want to really win a disproportionate share of brand budget, you need to be moving towards ROI. You need to have that measurement capability of incrementality. That means holding out control groups, measuring what that is. And if you have the ability, and maybe it's involving using third parties that can give you that out of your store measurement that gets you closer to true ROI, because what's going to happen?
It's not that hard, folks. It's not that hard, Peter and folks.
Revenue growth management is going to to gravitate to solutions that give you that ROI measurement.
All our lives, Peter, we've calculated incremental merchandising at the shelf, its value, things of that nature, both from a publisher and a buyer's perspective. Why is this any different, right? Like, the industry needs to evolve to that. So Peter, I know that was a strong opinion, so I want to go to something a little bit lighter now.
And Let's have some fun.
In the last few Fresh Fours, we've communicated heavily about brand mashups. There's the Coke Jack Daniels one, which in a previous life, of course, you and I have moved to you and I have evolved in our beverage choices to H2O. Nothing like an ice cold H2O, but in a previous life, that Coke Jack Daniels combo would have been spectacular. And then a few weeks ago, we talked about Taco Bell and Cheez-It. Actually, I think this week at the time of launching of the podcast, is this fun? Is it just happening just because? Is it performing? Like, what's the story here? Are they moving the needle? Are we going to see a whole lot of this in the future?
Well, I don't deny the fact that a good chunk of this is performative, right? It's taking some iconic brands, seeing how you can play off of each other's equity and get yourself in the public domain. So there's some of that. Does that mean, and I'm not saying that something like what Brown-Forman has done with Coca-Cola isn't going to have wheels. We've seen an enormous growth in ready-to-drink cocktail alcohol beverage, right, over the last couple of years. And so I think that's going to go well. You know, the Taco Bell Cheez-It, it's a limited-time offer. It gets some attention. What Mountain Dew is doing with their LTO flavors and co-branding with certain retailers. I think it's fun. I think it's taking something that we're all familiar with. Can you know, my daughter loves this. She's 3 years old, and there's a YouTube video where it says, "Do you like broccoli? Do you like ice? Do you like broccoli ice cream?" And in some cases, the answer is no, yucky. But every once in a while, there are two things that go together, and it's like chocolate and peanut butter, and boom, out comes the Reese's. So I think it's fun. I think it's nice. I don't necessarily think that every brand is going to try and go out and figure out what brand they can match up against. So I think the easier thing to do is look at basket data. Just go back to the data, right, Sri? See what, you know, see what's in the basket when your product is being purchased. And rather than try and create a flavor, just like find opportunities to co-promote in physical retail on end caps and what have you, and features, and in digital, you know, figure out how you can do some digital advertising together. But it doesn't necessarily mean you have to create a new product as a result of that. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, well said, Peter. I think, you know, as I tell those that work around me and people that I partner with every single day, this is a pretty mature industry that has been around, you know, over a century. And while still evolving, for the most part, I'd say a lot of skill sets in this industry are very ingrained and trained over the course of decades. So in a tough industry that's mature, you got to have some fun. These are like the fun moments. Innovation is some of the most fun moments in this industry. New product is some of the most fun moments. And I'm just speaking very broadly over here. Yeah. At the highest level of data, I think no matter what category you're in, approximately 5% of the category is really based on new products, new items, and innovation, which drives that fun. All of us as consumers wanting to come back more. That's what I see this as, Peter, at the end of the day. Keep that fun.
Well, you know who's not having fun right now? It's our friend Gary V. You know, Gary's been known for talking up crypto, talking up NFTs. And as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, there's been a real dip in those markets. We've had some companies collapse. We've had the value of all of this NFT inventory kind of come crashing back down to reality. So here's my question to you, Sri. Is this a setback? Is this, you know, maybe a little bit longer shelf life than, say, Clubhouse was, but is this just a flash in the pan, or is this just, hey, it still needs some retooling and needs to figure out how to do it, and it'll come back. It'll come back in some form a little bit stronger. We'd really love you handicapping where we are right now if you're comfortable doing that.
Wow, Clubhouse brings back memories when you were there. Summer of 2020, we didn't get an invite. The CPG guys did not get an invite to Clubhouse. And we really wanted an invite.
You know who was my favorite Clubhouse lurker? The Baroness of Bentonville. She loved to sit and listen to what was going on in all the Clubhouse rooms. And hey, another shout out to a dear friend of the family here. The maestro himself, Brian Gildenberg, is checking in. He says, he was hanging out with Paris Hilton and Cannes, so it's not all bad, I suppose. Ooh, nice. Okay, very good.
Brian, just again, I was looking at the data, Peter. He needs one download of his podcast to hit a magic number.
Oh, does he? Ooh, I think it's a big number. So, I love what Whitney. You and I don't. I've got the tapes, Whitney. You don't want to testify under oath there. But just kidding. Gary V. I think you're right, Brian. Yeah, Gary V was hanging out with. Who've we hung out with? Have we hung out with anyone like Paris Hilton? We hung out with Gino the Ghost. That's pretty cool, right?
I just met the entire New York Yankees one-on-one.
Oh, that is true. You did.
My bucket list is complete. That was the pinnacle of my bucket list at this stage. But I want to give a shout out to my close friend and the captain of the Promotion Optimization Institute, Mike Cantor. Mike has been good to me over the years. You know, I've been a keynote speaker opening the conference many a time. And Mike, I want to thank you for a friendship, because you've been good to me even when I've had days when I've not been too thrilled with how things are going in the industry. And what better time than now, Peter, than a Promotion Optimization Institute? Mike, this is your time, your heyday. Hope you're coaching the CPG industry well. Now let me answer Peter's question.
Yeah.
NFTs, cryptos. What the heck is going on,
right? What's going on, man?
So NFTs are non-fungible tokens. Just definition again, they're basically digital art. It can be interpreted in 30,000 ways, but it's digital art at the end of the day.
And utility. Let's not forget that aspect.
Starting to come up, but mostly still digital art. No different than physical art. And they got off to a very bullish start, kind of in line with how the overall investment market was. This morning, I picked up a piece of data from Wall Street, which gave me a very good summary of where the industry is with investments in general. And it looks like this, Peter. It says it can get a whole lot worse. For those of you who just watched the video, I looked at it across the board and I noticed that the crypto market, Bitcoin is down 60%. You know, consumer discretionary stocks are down 33%. And I can go on and on. The NASDAQ composite is down 30%. And when that happens, obviously, everything else is also going to come down together. So the bearishness of the crypto, Bitcoin, NFT is no different than, for example, if you wanted to sell your house today versus 6 months ago. We're in a different market now. The market squeezed down a lot. Getting the mortgages become harder. So the advantage that sellers have started to move more towards the advantage that buyers had is now starting to neutralize somewhat. This is no different. I believe the NFT market is really created by people who are 35 years or less. I mean, not that I'm calling out demographics, Gen Z, whatever you wish to call them. They are onto something here in terms of creating what I would call an epic ownership of assets. Just like the Bitcoin value, if you go back in a 10-year history, was nothing at some point in history and people regretted it. Peaked in 2020 over COVID, came back down, went back up. This will be no different. NFTs too, I've personally got the faith. We don't give advice on investments here. And CPG guys, that's your personal choice to research and look up. But yeah, at some point, Peter and I will take a deeper dive. I do believe we're going through a bearish market. And just like any other investment market, you have bears and bulls all the time. Do your research and the data will tell you that. And check out today's Wall Street Journal. It's the business pages center image that tells you about where markets are. So Peter, if that's how markets are, that's how investments are, things are more expensive, how does somebody build loyalty in these times?
Sri, I'm in the middle of listening to an audio book by a notable Bain & Company alum, Fred Reichheld, who is commonly known as the father of the Net Promoter Score. The book is called Winning on Purpose, and he interviews a bunch of different people that have built really big businesses, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, Chick-fil-A, a whole bunch of others. And what it comes down to is how you treat your customer. You know, if you treat your customer and work to delight them every day, that builds long-term loyalty. So whatever the mechanism is, you know, my general approach is that the less you ask your customers to jump through hoops, and the more you try and deliver them a really great experience, the more you're going to build loyalty. When you ask them to do lots of little things, which is tantamount to you prove your loyalty to me every day in every way possible, and then I'll give you a piecemeal reward. But instead, you find a way, you know, like what Walmart is doing with adding fuel savings to the Walmart Plus membership program. I mean, that's like spot on, right? Because that's a pain people are feeling. And every time they stop at a Walmart or they go to an Exxon or a Mobil that are part of that program and they buy gas, they're saving a little money. And that makes a world of difference. So the more you do things to delight your customer, you're going to build longer term loyalty. I think Walmart's just the prototypical example of someone who really got that and said, I'm going to quickly adjust my loyalty program to deliver against one of the biggest pain points my shoppers are feeling right now. And it may not be a lot. It's a couple pennies here and there, but it all adds up, right? Every little helps, as our friends over in the UK would say. That would be my general overview on how you build loyalty in these very trying times.
Well said, Peter. So I'm going to now, if these are trying times and that's how you build loyalty by adding value, you know, I often get asked in the industry, Sri, on the digital side of the fence, which conferences should we go to? Where can we learn? What's the learning mechanism? Big advocate for podcasts. We're not telling you to only listen to the CPG guys. On our website, you can find the list of podcasts we like. Go listen to them. But here's a magic question, Peter. I'd love for you to throw some light on. When people ask you that questions, are you going to lean towards in-person conferences? Do you think they're coming back with big traffic? Or if group settings, are people going to come back? Or are we always going to be in the hybrid mode? Are we going to lean more virtual, especially for these conferences and learning moments?
Well, I would say this, Sri. It's not just conferences. It's live meetings in general. If you're not out, so many big brand and retailers are back in their offices, maybe not full time, maybe not full scale, but they're there. And if you want to get business done, I mean, you got to go in person. I think I mentioned on the podcast that a couple of weeks ago, I went to New York City to do a class in omnichannel leadership. We had some really great, notable industry professionals talking about that. There, maybe even one of them is listening to this LinkedIn Live session right now. But in any event, that was a week of just pure networking and pure gold. So it's yes to all conferences. It's yes to live meetings. It's yes to just finding ways to connect with people in person, because it's a much richer experience than a Zoom meeting. It just is. And I'm not saying that Zoom can't function effectively. I'm just telling you that if you're there in front of someone live, you're going to get more done in a quicker manner. So yeah, we're doing it. Now, does that mean that if we have another uptick and all of a sudden we start to get more guarded and we move away from in-person? Yeah, it could certainly happen. We'll have to see what happens this fall when we're all indoors again. But right now I'm saying there's a lot of pent-up frustration. I mean, my God, just in general, everybody's been frustrated. Look at all the shift to travel-related expenses. This is the biggest travel day of the year. It's going to be bigger than, frankly, probably Thanksgiving this weekend, sure, because everybody wants to get out and go where they haven't been able to go for a couple of years. So yeah, I think in-person conferences, meetings, whatever. Yes, 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 yes. So Sri, I want to come to one question that I think you are eminently qualified to address, which is, and there's a lot that's baked into this, because at the end, so many of the issues we're dealing with our industry comes down to supply chain. You know, it's hard to walk into, you know, particularly regional retailers and not just see the effects on shelves, just empty spaces everywhere. People making decisions, they can't find the product that they usually buy. What else are they doing? I'll give you an example. NBC did a big hit on the news on Thursday. It was on NBC Now, it was on CNBC, and they were talking about the dramatic decrease in the coupon industry, right? About there just aren't as many coupons as there were a couple of years ago. Well, if you don't have enough inventory to satisfy demand, why are you going to discount and promote it? So here's my question. When are we going to see the supply chain constraints abate in a significant manner that, I don't want to say we're going to get back to normal, because I don't know if we ever are, but when are we going to see us be able to realize a much greater amount of capacity to satisfy demand in this country?
Good question, Peter. So first, let me wear my Sri hat and not my day job or even a CPG guy's hat. Let me wear a consumer hat, right? The most important thing for me and my fam as a consumer when I go in front of the shelf is I need to be able to get the product. So I need so that I can consume the product. Historically, that's been units, that's been multi-pack, whatever the case might be, I need the product. So I do admire those retailers and brands that have said, look, if there's an extra penny in the system, let's put it first towards supply chain, transportation, manufacturing, commodities, bring the product to the consumer and put it in front of her. That's the number one thing she's asking for. So that's why, Peter, you see maybe lesser coupons and things of that nature, because put all your effort into making sure she gets what she's asking for in the first place. If you're not doing that, you're already missing the bus. And if you can't get that product, what? She can't use the coupon anyway. So what's the point, right? But I want to go back to, when will this abate? Like, there's no crystal ball. But if I were to look at last year versus this year, same time, I would say supply chain constraints have eased a little bit. But the number one skill set, Peter, that I look for personally as a leader in the CPG industry over this long now is, who has resiliency to run this marathon supply chain ecosystem that's changing? Who's building for 3 years out? Who's taking a long-term approach to ensure that they can invest capital they may need to build 3 years out to avoid a black swan event like this in the future, and that they're ready? Who in up top senior is willing to act like a project manager and really decompose supply chain into the pieces to understand everything from commodity to manufacturing to transportation to retail warehouse distribution to cross dock all the way to the shelf? To me, that is the most important skill sets. For the next 2-3 years, everybody needs to be a supply chain. I'm not going to ask you to be an expert. Supply chain people are qualified to be expert. All of us need to, in the industry, retail and brands, understand supply chain to a depth we never have before. There are two reasons why, Peter. One is, we need to show empathy. Why do we need to show empathy? So that we can be calm, cool, collected, and deliver for her in terms of the product she's looking for on the shelf. The second thing why we need to all learn it is so we can decide where to put our big bets on from a supply chain perspective. One of that you've referred to, coupons, etc. But where to put our big bets, which products to put it on, and how we get it out to the shelf for digital or physical in the first place. So to answer Peter's question, when will supply chain constraints abate? I think nobody knows. But what I am more confident in the next 12 months, better than it's ever been, you know, again, pending some black swan event, which seems to be a wild card these days. And it's going to be a 2-3 year run, a marathon to get back to where we were 3 years ago. So your resiliency, your ability to work with numbers, analytics, plan, optimize is what's going to make the difference. I'd rather that's where people put their interest, time, energy. Optimize the pieces and the units that you have in your pocket so that it can get to her faster, better, quicker, more, and in the place where she wants to find them. So folks, this is fun. Peter and I hit up 14 different topics over here. I can't believe we've done 14 topics in an hour. I know it's the top of the hour, and we are going to wrap it up here. Before I do that, Peter, any closing comments from your side, and then I will wrap it up.
Yeah, first of all, another shout out to someone in the audience. My brother-in-law, Doug Ronan, is on the call. He's married to my my sister, Margaret. Doug, thanks for joining. Doug used to be he used to be VP of marketing for Driscoll's Berries. So if you have those wonderful strawberries and raspberries,
I buy them every week, Peter.
I know, aren't they delicious?
Now that just I know great, your brother-in-law is part of it, I'll be asking for coupons. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, there you go. Shri, I love doing this. You and I don't do it nearly enough. We do it in between ourselves, just when we talk all the time. But to have kind of this open conversation with our audience, we do need to do this more often. And I think that this format, a LinkedIn Live, is a great way to do it, to supplement what we do on the physical podcast. So I really like doing this. Let's try and do this more frequently, right?
Yep. We also promise you, you know, this one came about in 24 hours last night. Peter and I chatted, say, hey, what are you doing this long weekend? And we said, let's just hit it up before people go off into picnics, beaches, barbecues, and watching fireworks. We promise we'll give you much more notice next time. For the many of you that joined us live today, I cannot say thank you enough times. For our amazing audience now crossing and hitting close to 14K followers on LinkedIn, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for writing direct messages, comments, likes, shares. When you meet us in the industry, shaking our hands, telling us that you actually find value out of what we do. I can tell you, Peter and I, when we started this 2 years, we had no idea this is how big the CPG guys would become. You have made it big. Thank you. Let me close out by saying you can find all of our content easily by going to a browser, going to cpgguys.com. We are proud to be partners with Next Stop, what used to be known as the Network of Executive Women Advancing Gender Equality. You can find us now on nextupisnow.org/CPGguys, where you can learn about events as well as how to register and become a part of this amazing network that is promoting gender equality. Thank you, folks. That is a wrap for this LinkedIn Live event, which hit the mid-year, what I would call mid-year 22 state of the industry for CPG and retail. Of course, Peter and I lean a little bit more on CPG. Thank you, folks. Wednesday, we have another episode coming up. Happy the 4th. Happy Independence Day, America. Happy Canada Day for our Canadian listeners that just passed by yesterday. And we will catch you soon on the next episode of the CPG Guys. Thank you.
The content in this podcast episode is provided for general informational purposes only. By listening to our episode, you understand that no information contained in this episode should be construed as advice from CPG Guys LLC or the individual author, hosts, or guests, nor is it intended to be a substitute for research on any subject matter. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by CPG Guys LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views expressed by CPG Guys LLC do not represent the views of their employers or the entity they represent. CPG Guys LLC expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, or inability to use this podcast or the information we present in this podcast.